This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The so-called money revolution has changed financial life for the middle class. Those changes are the subject of the new book, A Piece of the Action, by Joseph Nocera, who writes the profit motive column for GQ magazine. Not too long ago, when a middle-class person needed a loan, he or she would go to the bank, where a loan officer would decide how much to give and what it could be spent on. Now, with credit cards, the customer decides how and when to spend large sums of money and when to pay it back. The middle class used to put its savings into savings accounts. Now there are options like CDs, money market funds, short-term bond funds, and mutual funds. Nocera says that for many people, these new options have brought a new level of financial confusion and nagging fears that they made the wrong choice or their money's at risk.
One of the things that I get at a little bit in the book is the degree to which mutual funds were begun as a device to make financial life easier. In other words, you, a middle-class person who does not have time to investigate the stock market, can give your money to a company that has professional managers who do nothing but think about the stock market day and night. And there was, I've always believed that part of the rise of the mutual fund industry has been this comfort factor, the sense that, okay, they were going to do this for you. And the degree to which this was simpler than trying to, you know, figure out which of the, you know, 3,000 stocks on the New York Stock Exchange you should put your money into. In fact, we've gotten to the point where there are now somewhere around 6,000 mutual funds. There are twice as many mutual funds as there are stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, which is just an incredibly staggering statistic. And so mutual funds, which began as this way to make life simpler, have actually made life much more complicated. And when people are given 401k plans, which is the classic thing that's happening in America today, and they're told, okay, here's a 401k, you know, good luck, and hope you have enough to retire on, it's up to them to decide which funds to put it in and, you know, whether to go for a growth fund or a balanced fund and all this kind of stuff. And people's eyes just tend to glaze over and they say, you know, I can't face it. I can't deal with it. And I think that's what a lot of people are feeling in America today. And I think that's one of the reasons there's so much anxiety about money today.
One of the things you write about in your new book is how the era of inflation in the 70s changed the middle class's thinking about spending and saving. And how, even though that era of inflation may be over, a lot of us are still thinking in the same patterns. What spending and saving patterns were changed by inflation?
What happened in the era of inflation was that people realized that those old values of thrift, of not borrowing, of not being in the market, of not thinking about your money were passé. They didn't work anymore. And the classic example, and this is what really began this major change in American life. It's 1980. The prime rate is 20%. The inflation rate is 13%. The Treasury bills are offering 15, 16, 17%. And there you are with your money in the bank, and it's earning 5.25% because it's federally regulated. The money in bank passbooks account was regulated by the federal government. And that's what they wanted it to be, and they wanted it to be 5.25% for a whole bunch of historical reasons. And you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you think to yourself, oh, my God, what is my money doing in the bank? I'm getting killed. And so this process began where one person after another would take that money out of the bank, and they would put it in this thing called a money market fund, which wasn't even that old as an investment vehicle. It was only 6 or 7 years old. But it was a place where you could begin to get real-world interest rates instead of bank interest rates. Thus began this long historical trek of middle-class money out of the bank and into what eventually became the market. That's one side of it. The other side of it has to do with borrowing behavior. I mean, I firmly believe that inflation taught Americans that it made sense to borrow. Because you were buying, if you borrowed, you were buying things with cheaper dollars than if you saved the money and paid for it in cash.
Well, why would that be?
If you borrowed on a credit card and you timed it properly and you bought a refrigerator with a credit card, the bill didn't come due for, say, 45 days. So in essence, you're getting an interest-free loan for 45 days. During those 45 days, when inflation is really rearing its ugly head, prices may have gone up, of refrigerators may have gone up 5 or 6%. So by borrowing, you were in effect paying 5 or 6% less money than if you had paid cash for that same good.
So do you think that inflation-era attitudes are still operating in the middle class today, and are we still in an inflationary period?
I don't think we're in an inflationary period. I do think that the that ethos remains in effect. What I basically believe is that people's economic behavior changes in the wake of a cataclysmic economic event. And then it doesn't change again until there's another event to force it to change. So the Depression was one event. And so even though you had the wonderful 1950s, there was a lot of depression. The mentality of the Depression still stuck. And then you had inflation, which basically forced people. It wasn't dramatic the way the Depression was, but it did force people to change their economic behavior. And then we haven't had a new cataclysmic economic event to make them change again. There's been nothing sort of compelling that tells people, you know, stop borrowing or put your money in the bank. And that's why I think behavior has stayed the same, even though the event itself has receded into memory.
How should the middle class, do you think, be adjusting its spending and saving now that we're out of the inflation era?
One of the things that happened in the era of inflation and that really propelled the bull market of the 1980s was this notion that people had that they had a God-given right to double-digit yields. So if you're getting in a money market fund 15% circa 1980, 1981, and interest rates start coming down, I think one of the things that really propelled money in the market is the sense that people had is, you know, by God, you know, I was getting 15%. I still want to get 15%. And if I can't get it in a money market fund, then I'm going to go into the market. I'm going to put my money in Fidelity, Magellan, you know, whatever I need to do. I've always thought that economists will tell you there's something very sort of deceptive and wrongheaded about the notion that they were in fact getting 15% during that era, because what they were really doing was that they were beating the inflation rate by about 2%. So even though they were getting 15%, inflation was cutting 13% of that away. So here we are today, and people are still, as they say, chasing for yield. They're not trying to get 11 or 12 because that's kind of impossible these days, but they're still trying to get 6, 7, 8% in an era when Treasury bills are yielding 4 and 5%. And what's deceptive about that and what's causing them to have problems about that is that the gap between what you're getting in a Treasury bill and what inflation is still only about 2%. I mean, the difference really, it's really not that different. But people have it in their brain that they ought to be able to get higher interest. They ought to be able to get more money on their money. So they're chasing after something that's basically going to cause them problems because it entails a kind of risk that I believe most Americans are uncomfortable with.
A good deal of your book is devoted to credit cards and the history of the credit card and, you know, how the credit card has changed. What is so important about the credit card and how it changed the spending habits of the middle class?
The credit card really is the device that gave you control over your borrowing habits. And that I've always thought one of the more, to me, the more interesting thing about the credit card is the psychological effect it has on Americans. They know it's important. They know that they need to take care of they have to be responsible with their credit and so on. And yet it bubbles up all these issues of temptation and willpower and sin and, this notion that they can get into trouble tomorrow if they don't watch out. I remember during the course of researching the book, I would go to a party and I would say, I would just sort of offhandedly mention that I was researching the history of credit cards. And it would be like dropping a hand grenade in the room or something. I mean, all of a sudden, this thing that had resided in people's subconscious came flooding to the front of their brain. And I would, you know, be assaulted with questions like, you know, how can they send me these solicitations? Don't they know I already have 9 credit cards? What are they trying to do to me? Why won't they leave me alone? And everybody had a tale about a credit report that was inaccurate, and everybody had a tale about a collection agency going after them unfairly, and these were people who basically upper middle class people who were in control of their credit, who could afford to pay their bills on time, et cetera, et cetera. So the credit card has had, I think, among every other thing, enormous psychological ramifications in the way people think about their own borrowing behavior.
Well, one of the early big events in the history of the credit card is in 1958, when Bank of America sends out 60,000 credit cards to residents of Fresno, California, floating this new idea.
Right.
What was the experiment?
No one had ever before devised a card that could be used that could both be used in a whole bunch of different places, different kind of stores, and that also gave you the capability either to borrow or to pay it off at the end of the month. I mean, that choice became yours. And that's one of the ways people had to kind of decide for themselves. Do I want to be a borrower or do I want to use it as a convenience device? Also, the Bank of America card was the first one that was really aimed at middle-class people. The American Express card and the Diners Club before that were really aimed at professionals, and they had this kind of business aura about them. The second thing about it that I found sort of fascinating, especially given the degree to which credit cards are this immense, impersonal, computerized business today, is that it was intended actually not to be impersonal, but to be just to be one of these wonderful things, wonderful tools that bond you to your wonderful bank, the Bank of America, which, of course, didn't happen at all. I mean, even in Fresno and even in California, where the Bank of America card quickly spread, this resentment came up right away. People were very upset at the idea that they could walk into their mailbox one day and there would be this piece of plastic there that gave them borrowing capabilities. It was very, very bothersome to people. And they really did feel that the Bank of America was doing the devil's work.
So what was the result of this experiment?
Well, the result of the experiment was that everybody started using credit cards. And that's what's so interesting about it. They blanketed the state of California with cards within less than a year because they had heard a rumor that another bank was going to get into the business, and the Bank of America was so big and powerful they just want to flatten the competition. And because in those days you could just send the cards out and you didn't have to solicit as you do today, you know, crooks got cards, dogs got cards. I mean, this is kind of one of the more famous events in the history. It happened again in the 60s in America, but it happened in California first in the 50s. And there was a huge outcry. That's the other thing. I mean, you can't overemphasize. You know, cards were denounced from pulpits and churches all over the state. Many of the sort of well-to-do citizenry who had gotten cards, you know, cut them up and sent them to the bank and said, I'm moving my money out of this bank in protest, et cetera, et cetera. There was this giant outcry.
So how did the credit card survive when everything went so wrong?
Well, this, I think, gets to the psychology. It actually does offer convenience. It really does. And especially when we get to the 60s, and credit cards start blanketing the country. The same thing happens in the country that happened in California. I mean, 100 million cards. This is an amazing fact. 100 million cards got dropped on America between 1968 and 1970 when it was outlawed, the dropping of cards. And there were so many cards in circulation that people, you know, gradually started using them.
Joseph Nocera is my guest. His new book is called A Piece of the Action, and it's about how spending and saving has changed in the middle class. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Nocera. He's the author of a new book called A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. What is the difference between MasterCharge and Visa, or MasterCard and Visa?
There isn't any. I mean, they're two separate organizations, and part of what the book, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about Visa, mainly because it used to be the Bank AmeriCard. The name was changed in 1977, but when the industry was just beginning to come into its own, banks had to decide, am I going to go with the Bank AmeriCard? Am I going to line up with them and be a franchise bank for the Bank AmeriCard? Or am I going to be a franchise bank with this organization called MasterCharge? It was called Interbank, but MasterCharge was the card that they issued. And basically, there were two competing organizations. They're not banks. All they are is they offer the kind of back office computerized systems that make the whole thing work smoothly. And basically, the country got divided into Bank AmeriCard banks and MasterCharge banks. They competed fiercely for about 10 years. But what happened was Worthen Bank in Arkansas sued Bank AmeriCard, claiming that they had that it was antitrust implications to them not being allowed to carry both cards. And fundamentally, the Justice Department wound up agreeing with Worth and Bank. The bank was allowed to take both cards, as was every other bank in the country. And at that point, the two organizations, although they do still compete in many countries, are peas in a pod in the United States. I mean, there's virtually no difference between the two of them.
Don't a lot of people have MasterCard and Visa now?
Oh, everybody does. I mean, you know, absolutely. And it makes absolutely no difference. I mean, what matters really is the bank that issues the card to you and how good they are and what kind of credit standards. And really, the things people care about these days with credit cards have nothing to do with MasterCard and Visa. They have to do with, you know, what's the interest rate and what's the minimum payment and, you know, can I get frequent flyer miles?
Exactly, right.
You know, which is the one great perk in credit cards. Which also shows, by the way, what a commodity this thing has become. I mean, there's such, you know, six of one, half dozen another, that if you can offer frequent flyer miles, that's the way to get, as they say in the trade, primacy in the wallet, that's what they call the card that you take up most often. I mean, the one psychological thing they do understand in the business is that if you have five cards in your pocket, you have mentally categorized each of those five cards, and they do different things for you.
Another really big event in the history of the credit card was the recent entry of AT&T into the credit card world. You said this was the banker's worst nightmare. What was the significance of it?
Well, it's true. It was. See, as long as banks had this little business to themselves, they kind of had this implicit, unspoken agreement that they would keep interest rates high and that they would continue to charge annual fees. What happened when AT&T jumped into the game was that they had a completely different set of standards and of profit expectations. So they went out and they said, no annual fee for life if you take this card. And there was a deluge of people to take the card. They didn't start, I won't say they started 8 or 9%, but they started at 16 or 17%. So suddenly the interest rate becomes a factor in the way people are thinking about cards. And two things have happened subsequently. The first is that 45% of the credit card business in this country is now done by non-banks, which is an astounding fact. This thing was built by banks. It was made for banks. It was a banker's device. And so what had been the cushiest of deals for the bank has now become the credit cards are only, believe it or not, in many cases only marginally profitable, and it's become immensely competitive in a way that it wasn't as recently as 4 years ago. There's one other wonderful little thing that's going on in that world right now, which I find at least amusing. You get these solicitations, I'm sure you've gotten them, where they say, the bank will say, if you move your balance to us, we'll only charge you 7 or 8% on that balance. Have you gotten these?
I've got my credit cards. I don't need more. Right. And so I don't even read what they send me.
Right.
But unless it's about frequent flyer miles.
Right. This is the new technique. They're saying, you know, we'd like to offer you a credit card, but what we really want is your unpaid balance because that's how we make money. And therefore, we'll just charge you 8-9% if you send us your unpaid balance. And the term in the trade for that is balance piracy or balance poaching, I think they call it. And that's what it's come to for the banks. The only way they can make money on credit cards now is stealing each other's unpaid balances.
When you look at the pluses and minuses, do you think on the whole the middle class has benefited by the proliferation of credit cards?
The whole business of whether this whole financial revolution has been good or bad, I think, is a really, really difficult thing to grapple with. I actually think that there is something to be said for life in the 50s, in this particular case at least, that the nostalgia is not misplaced. I think there's something debilitating about having to think about your money all the time. And I think that, there's so much else to life besides your money, and that American culture can get sort of caught up in this in a way that is unhealthy. On the other hand, because we live in the times that we live in, because inflation took place, because You know, the real world is so complicated, and we are all connected to the markets and so on and so forth. I do think that much of what's happened is basically inevitable, and that, you know, you sort of just have to deal with it. And this is both on the credit side and on the investment and savings side. It's not fun necessarily, but there is something democratic. I mean, you know, in 1970, this is one example that really drives me crazy and really made me think, oh, yeah, this stuff was good that it happened. In 1970, interest rates hit 8%, which was the highest they'd been since the Civil War. And it was a shock to a lot of people that interest rates would actually fluctuate after being the same for 25 years or so. And a lot of Americans went to the Federal Reserve to buy Treasury bills, which you could then get for $1,000. This was their way of kind of trying to deal with the high interest rates. And the government reacted by raising the minimum on a T-bill from $1,000 to $10,000. And why? I mean, the reason they did that was to force middle-class money back into the bank and to basically prevent middle-class people from getting the kind of returns that are common for wealthy people. And so, I mean, to the extent that this has brought about financial democracy and that it's allowed all of us to participate in something that only wealthy people could participate in, I think that's good. The hard part is that wealthy people usually have financial advisors, and they don't, you know, they are generally quite often educated about the markets, and they have some sense of what they're risking and what they're doing. And I think middle-class people are still learning how to cope with this world.
Joseph Nocera, he's the author of A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. He writes the Profit Motive column for GQ. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.